Hello and welcome to the GHJ show here on Leeds Student Radio. My name is Georgia. I'll be with you until 4 p.m. today discussing capital punishment. Sounds like it's going to be quite heavy, but I've basically decided that this year I want to become more informed about a variety of global issues that I, in all honesty, know too little about. So I think the death penalty is an important one, as the conversation around it is quite a nuanced debate. So thanks for tuning in this afternoon. Each week I'll be looking at the challenges that we face in society that arise from private matters like domestic violence, as well as issues that are happening on an unbelievable scale worldwide like food waste. Hopefully by exploring both the history and the contemporary challenges posed by each issue, I'll have a better idea of how we can get involved as students to make a difference today. So coming up on the show, I'll be looking at the history of how capital punishment has evolved and sort of transformed in different societies over time. And I'll be joined in the studio by someone from the Anti-Death Penalty Society and then the president of LUU Amnesty International a little later on in the show. So it's going to be jam-packed, and as ever, you can tweet it your views on this obviously controversial subject at ThisIsLSR using the hashtag GHJ. But right now, let's have a little bit of hippie sabotage to start us off. Welcome back to the GHJ show. I'm discussing capital punishment this week, and that was a little bit of Stay High. I think it's important to look at how the death penalty has changed and developed over history. So what we're talking about here is a legal process whereby a person is put to death by the state as a punishment for a crime in its most, you know, simple terms. The judicial degree that can be that someone can be punished in this manner is a death sentence, while the actual enforcement is an execution. So capital punishment has in the past been practiced by most societies, both to punish crime and to suppress political dissent, and the use of formal execution extends to the beginning of recorded history, really. Most historical records and various primitive tribal practices indicate that the death penalty was a part of their justice system. In some tribal societies, the person offered for execution didn't even have to be the original perpetrator of the crime, which is quite difficult to get your head around nowadays. But some other historical examples include various readings of the Torah, where Jewish law lays down the death penalty for murder, kidnapping, magic, violation of the Sabbath, blasphemy, and a wide range of sexual crimes. The Tang Dynasty in China used strangulation and decapitation as the prescribed methods of execution. I mean, there were lots of different strange ones, but you could be strangled for lodging an accusation against your parents, or opening a coffin whilst desecrating a tomb. And decapitation was then used for more serious crimes such as treason. Interestingly, despite the great discomfort involved, most of the Tang Chinese preferred strangulation as a result of the traditional belief that the body is a gift from your parents and that it's therefore disrespectful to return to one's ancestors to die without having, you know, your body intact. So despite the wide use of the death penalty throughout sort of societies in ancient history, calls for reform were not unknown. For instance, a 12th century Jewish legal scholar wrote, "It is better and more satisfactory to acquit 1,000 guilty persons than to put a single innocent man to death." So quite a powerful argument there. He argued that executing an accused criminal on anything less than absolute certainty kind of leads to a slippery slope. You know, he was concerned for maintaining popular respect for law. So now let's fast forward a few years to early modern Europe, where the death penalty was also used as a sort of general form of punishment before the prison system that we now know. Interestingly, last week I was discussing moral panics and how they arise around certain issues, and there was a period during early modern Europe when a moral panic regarding witchcraft swept across Europe. I'm sure most of you listening will have sort of heard about this in school. So during this period, there were widespread claims that malevolent satanic witches were operating as an organised threat to Christendom, and as a result, thousands of women were prosecuted and executed through sort of the 15th and 18th centuries. By 1820 in Britain, there were 160 crimes that were still punishable by death, which quite shocked me, because that's a lot. That's a large, staggering statistic. You know, these crimes included shoplifting or petty theft, stealing cattle, cutting down trees in a public place, and they seem like minor crimes. Although, of course, the severity of this so-called bloody code was often tempered by juries who refused to convict, or judges, in the case of petty theft, for example, they might have arbitrarily set the value stolen at below the statutory level for a capital crime, which I imagine, well, I think that's sort of somewhat reassuring. Even more recently, in Nazi Germany, for instance, there were three types of capital punishment: hanging, decapitation, and death by shooting. And modern military organisations within the last century have employed capital punishment as a means of maintaining military discipline. I mean, this is just out. I'm not even sure I could believe this, but the Soviets are said to have executed 158,000 soldiers for desertion during the World War. So hopefully that's given you an overview of how capital punishment had its origins in ancient history and how it has developed over time until, you know, really recent living memory. Next up, I'll be looking at the more contemporary landscape and the conversation around the death penalty. Right after a bit of Drake, Hold On, We Are Going Home.
Get over you left your mark. get over you. You left your mark on me. I want your high love and emotion endlessly. Cause you're a good girl and you know it. You act so different around me. Cause you're a good girl and you know it. I know exactly who you could be. So just hold on. Hold on.
That was a bit of Drake, Just Hold On, We're Going Home, and you're listening to the GHJ Show here on Leeds Student Radio. Don't forget, you can tweet me at This Is LSR, use the hashtag GHJ, get involved on the conversation, talking about capital punishment here today. So let's look at the current picture. Almost all European and many Pacific area states like Australia, New Zealand, and also Canada have abolished capital punishment. In Latin America, for example, most states have completely abolished it, while some countries such as Brazil allow it only in exceptional situations such as treason committed during war crimes. On the other hand, 32 American states and its federal government, of course, and the majority of democracies in Asia and Africa such as Japan, India, Botswana, Zambia, retain the use of capital punishment. And when I found this out, doing a bit of research for the show today, I was surprised. I really didn't think it was that widespread. I lived in Zambia for 3 months and really had no idea, you know, that was kind of still going on. I think abolition was often adopted due to political change, for instance, when countries shifted from a more authoritarian government to a democracy, or when it became an entry condition to the European Union. And the United States is, of course, a notable exception on that list. Some states have had bans on capital punishment for decades. I think the earliest is Michigan. It was abolished there in 1846. While others actively use it today, and understandably the death penalty there especially remains a contentious issue. It's really hotly debated. In abolitionist countries, debate is sometimes revived by particularly brutal murders, but a few countries have brought it back after abolishing it. However, you know, for example, a spike in serious violent crimes such as murders or terrorist attacks has prompted some countries, such as Sri Lanka and Jamaica, to effectively end the moratorium on the death penalty. Worldwide trends have been to move to less painful, or, you know, what's known as more humane executions. France, for instance, developed the guillotine for this reason in the final years of the 18th century, while Britain, a little closer to home, banned drawing and quartering in the early 19th century. In the US, methods initially introduced to be more humane, like the electric chair, have been almost entirely superseded by lethal injection. But, you know, many modern critics in turn criticise this as still being too painful, still being inhumane. And I think we'll hear more on that later when I'll be joined by a member of the Anti-Death Penalty Committee and also the president of LU Amnesty International. So just to have a look at, you know, modern day public opinion, it really varies considerably surrounding the death penalty, varies by country and by the crime in question, despite, you know, some would argue the evidence against its power as a deterrent, but also, you know, the humanity and whether that really is effective. In the UK, it was abolished for murder permanently in 1969, and the last execution took place in 1964. But really, for all peacetime offences, it was only abolished in 1998. I mean, that's within our lifetimes. That's crazy. In the US, 18 states have banned capital punishment, but a 2010 Gallup poll showed that 64% of Americans support the death penalty for someone convicted of murder, and of the state where the death penalty is permitted, California has the largest number of inmates on death row, but Texas has performed the most executions. I mean, in another example, the use of capital punishment has actually grown recently in India due to both a growth in right-wing politics and, of course, widespread anger over several recent brutal cases of rape. And although many nations have abolished capital punishment, over 60% of the world's population live in countries where executions take place, such as China, India, the United States, of course, and Indonesia, four of the most populous countries in the world, which continue to apply the death penalty. I think these are quite staggering statistics, and it demonstrates that capital punishment is a huge contemporary issue. Currently, now, 2015, it's still being hotly debated on a global scale. So after a little bit of Jack Johnson, I'm going to be joined in the studio by a member of the Anti-Death Penalty Society to get their views on this nuanced conversation. So do stay tuned for that, and don't forget that you can tweet at This Is LSR, use the hashtag GHJ, because I'd love to hear your views, especially when we're getting into some more debate side of things a little later on in the show. So stay tuned for that.
Say Taylor was a good girl, never want to be late, complain, express ideas in her brain. Working on the night shift, passing out the tickets, you're gonna have to pay her if you wanna park here. Well, mommy's little dancer is quite a little secret, working on the streets now, never gonna keep it. Position, and now she's only wishing that she would have listened to the words they said. Poor Taylor, she just wanders around, unaffected by the winter winds, yeah. And she'll pretend that she's somewhere else, so far and clear, about 2,000 miles. Used to be a limber chicken, times have been a tick, and now she's finger licking to the doctor flying in his rocket, only stopping by on his way to a better world. If Taylor finds a better world,
welcome back to the GHJ show. You're listening to Lee's Student Radio, and I'm now joined in the studio by Leo, who is a member of the Anti-Death Penalty Society. Very exciting. Hi, Leo.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Very excited to be here.
Yeah.
So exciting opportunity.
Good.
Finally on the student radio after 4 years of waiting.
Someone's finally invited you.
Yeah.
Woo! Loving life. Great. So why don't you start? Just tell us a little bit about your society.
Yeah, of
and
course.
And your involvement.
Yeah, no, completely. So I actually wasn't involved until this year. I was on a year abroad last year, but a friend of mine called Molly set up the society in the last academic year, kind of just basically realizing that there was an interest in the death penalty, even though we don't have it in the UK, wanting to kind of give it a platform to have speakers to learn more about it and even venture into kind of campaigns. And yeah, kind of also with an emphasis on education, getting dialogue going. So yeah, that's when it started, and I've been involved this year as events organizer.
Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. So how does the society aim to educate students about mm-hmm. the death penalty?
So this year has been, I mean, we're still a very new society, so I think we're still trying to like find our feet, really understand like how things work, what we do, what's good, what's bad. But this year we've done two or three big events. We've had the two big events we've had have been Skype-ins, so from America, from death row exonerees themselves, one of which, he was called Ray Crone, and the other Jason Baldwin. Jason wasn't actually on death row himself, but he was involved very closely with the death row case. We wanted to hear their story in terms of the legal perspective, how the law came into it, and like really it kind of exposed the corruption of the justice system in the US, but also try and understand it on a more emotional level. So seeing how, you know, things went from bad to worse, also understanding how afterwards, how they rebuilt their life, how they, you know, did or didn't have faith whilst they were on death row, because they were on death row for so many years. So some of them found it really hard, but some of them really were strong and had faith that one day they'd be able to leave and be free again.
Why is the society focusing its campaigns on the USA at the moment? I mean, mm-hmm. that's obviously a great place to start, but
yeah.
Do you think the plans are to expand it on a more global scope?
I mean, I think ideally, yes, it would be great to start to look at it in different countries. I think the US is such a big deal for us at the moment because the US is very, it's not close to home, but the UK and the US, you know, we can draw parallels. We're both very advanced Western societies, both got quite a big world power status, and you know, to know that in the UK this is, you know, not spoken of, it's not a thing that's being practiced at the moment, whereas in the US it's still prominent, and I think it's 32 states it's still legal, not legal, but still used as a means of like justice. So I think for that reason it's very interesting, and also to, you know, everyone's know someone from the US, maybe they've been to the US, and we've grown up watching American shows. I think it's interesting for people in this country to explore that side of it. And I also think it wasn't that long ago, in 2013 there was actually a parliament bill looking into the possibility of bringing back capital punishment for certain offences. It didn't go through. It got sent back very, very quickly, but you know, it's something that could one day arise again, whichever way politics might diverge from, you know, this general election and in the next 10-20 years. Like it's not completely ridiculous to think one day the UK might see capital punishment again. So I think it's good to know about it.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting you said, so British students might be able to draw more of a parallel to their own lives by mm-hmm. focusing on the USA.
Yeah.
And, What do you think could be done to lead to the abolition of the death penalty in more states or more countries?
Mm-hmm. It's a really good question. I'm definitely not claiming to have the answers. And I don't think anyone else on the committee or who's been involved in the society would. I think what we focus on is trying to look at alternatives to the death penalty and thinking about the kind of effects that the death penalty has on a society, like what, like the detriment of that. You know, what kind of example are we setting if we say that, you know, by law state sanctioned punishment is allowed? Like, what is that message that we're sending to the younger generations? Obviously, I'd love to see it abolished worldwide, but I think, you know, the main thing to focus on is alternatives, so things like life imprisonment without parole, and also focusing on, there's been a lot of work to do with how the people who survive attacks or like who are rape victims of people who are on death row and who witness the person on death row being put to death, you know, they often come out and say, I don't feel like I still, because that's going to stay with them forever, that kind of feeling of like anger and hatred. It doesn't go away just because that person is dead. So I think trying to get it at the root of the problem, like, and knowing that it's not necessarily beneficial for our society, even though in the short term for a victim, I can understand, you know, like that is something that I would want, I might want, you know, I might want that feeling of revenge. But looking at it on the long term, it's not necessarily the best for anybody.
So you believe that it's sort of state sanctioned murder can never be justified? I mean, some people, I mean, mm-hmm. yeah, you said, like you said, some people will, they'll never lose that, the feeling mm-hmm. of what happened to them. But I think some would argue that mm-hmm. they might gain that sense of closure. They might argue that capital punishment is really the only just response mm-hmm. to such horrific crimes. I mean, what would you say to them? Like, would you say about other alternatives, like you mentioned earlier?
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think, you know, it's all well and good me sitting here harping on about how I'd love the death penalty to be outruled in all countries, but I've never been in the position, I've never been a victim of any sort of crime that could be punished by the death penalty. So really that's a case of me like knowing my limit, knowing that I'm going to say something to a certain level, but knowing that I can never hopefully I'll never be in the position to say that I understand what that feels like. Because no one deserves to feel like that. But yes, I would very much push alternatives, look into those sort of things. And really also, I think we've lost in our justice system in the UK, I think, and very much in the US as well, we've lost this element of education, re-education, rehabilitation, within the prison system. And people, you know, the rate of re-offenders is so high. And I think that's worth looking into as well. And you know, the death penalty, sure, it's putting someone to death and they're never going to reoffend again. But is that the way we want to continue to live?
Yeah, that's really interesting. So maybe it's part of this wider conversation mm-hmm. about other punishments that need to also be scrutinized.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So finally, mm-hmm. how can students get involved with your ongoing mm-hmm. campaigns, with events? What's coming up?
Mm-hmm. Well, we've actually got our probably the biggest event that we'll have this year coming up next week, on Wednesday. It's going to be at 6:30 in Conference Auditorium 2. And you can get tickets on our LUU Society page. We've got two death row survivors coming, called Sunny and Peter. And we'll be hearing from them about their experience. So Sunny was on death row for 17 years in the US. And Peter for 15 years in Ireland, when Ireland used to have the death row. And they were both accused of murders that they didn't commit, both of which were accused of murdering police officers. And they were both found out to have been... I think their stories really expose the corruption and the politics within the justice system, which is, I think, one of the most interesting parts of their talk. But also how they kept the faith alive. They both have mentioned, and if you come to the talk next week you'll hear it as well, how they both like kind of kept going with yoga, meditation, things like that, just to keep like ticking on day to day. But we're all really excited for the event. And Peter's story is actually really interesting, because he kind of educated himself whilst in prison, kind of about the law. He was kind of known as like a jailhouse lawyer. So he was reading a lot about criminal law, criminal justice, and he managed to push his own, like his own appeal. And he's now a human rights activist and an anti-death penalty activist. So his story is amazing. And kind of how they both met each other afterwards, which I don't want to give like a spoiler too much, because that's a really lovely part of their story. But they essentially met both after having very similar experiences, and that part of, I think a great thing to focus on is also like the rebuilding of their lives. Because, you know, when you're on death row, your whole life is turned upside down. You're just waiting to be killed, and then suddenly one day you're free. So that, I think, is a very interesting sentiment to explore.
So that's at 6:30, is it?
6:30 next Wednesday, Conference Auditorium 2. And if you want more information, you can go join our Facebook page. It's LUU Anti-Death Penalty Society. And we've got a Twitter as well, but I can't remember the handle off the top of my head.
We'll find out during the next song and tell
okay,
you.
Okay, okay, brilliant. And also, if you go to our society page, it's free membership. So you can just do that through your LUU sign-in, login account. So
wonderful. Yeah. So after the next song, we'll be joined in the studio by Will. He's the president of Amnesty International here at Leeds. And we'll be discussing so many interesting points that you've touched upon there. Mm-hmm. We'll go into them in a bit more debate.
Definitely.
But first up, a little bit of Alt J.
Oh,
Welcome back to the GHJ show. I'm now joined in the studio by Will, who is the president of LUU Amnesty International, and of course is still here with Leo. I'm going to give a little bit of background and then we'll get into some questions and debate. Amnesty International, sort of on a national level, are against the death penalty, no matter what the crime is and who is the perpetrator, for a number of reasons. I'll just outline them a little bit. Amnesty argue that capital punishment is the ultimate denial of human rights, as sentencing someone to death denies that individual the right to life, which is guaranteed under international law. And Amnesty also claim that the death penalty is often used within skewed justice systems. So this really touches what Leo touched upon earlier with the political side of things. This is really interesting. Countries executing the most people are often the same countries about which we might have, you know, sort of quite serious concerns regarding the fairness of their justice systems, judicial systems in general. You know, the top three executing countries, China, Iran, Iraq, all guilty of sort of issuing death sentences under, you know, circumstances that are not very transparent. And also capital punishment discriminates. You're more likely to be sentenced to death if you are a member of a minority group within a state in America that executes, certainly. The death penalty, therefore, disproportionately affects members of racial, ethnic and religious minorities, as well as those living in poverty. That's another sort of circumstance. So let's cross over to Will for a little more of an insight into these kind of ideas. At least 18,750 people worldwide were under sentence of death at the beginning of 2012. That is mind-blowing. Like, when I asked someone in the studio earlier, you know, how many people do you think, and he said 250. I mean, this is on a massive, massive scale. So how is capital punishment still so widespread in 2015?
Well, it's a very good question. I mean, if we break that down, it's actually come a long way. The Amnesty International's campaign and global movements against the death penalty have made a lot of progress in the last 20 years. I mean, since 1990, 30 more countries have removed the death penalty from their legislation. So it's actually, if you look at it in that sense, it's making progress. If you look at it further as well, I think it's between 80-90% of all executions are carried out by just five states. So you mentioned China, Iraq and Iran, Saudi Arabia and the USA also make it into that list, unfortunately, but within those five, Vietnam a little bit, they make up the vast majority. And so it's quite, at this point, it's now not so much a ideological campaign. We can sort of focus it down on these states. So if we look at, for example, today in Iran, there was an execution for Saman Nassim, which was called off at the last minute, and the pressure is still very, very focal, very, very vocal, sorry, very focused around sort of individual cases now, rather than just widespread, you know, banners on the street, which I think is a positive thing.
So you think it's good that we have more sort of, yeah, focus, like you said, directed criticism. But I mean, do you think more need to be done to abolish the death penalty on a more global scale? Or do you think it's better now to focus on more individual cases?
I think we're lucky because we're at the point where we can focus on individual cases. And so at this point, we're no longer sort of firing shots in the dark and hoping that they hit an activist. Not literally, obviously, but we're able to focus, and I think that's definitely a positive. Yeah,
I mean, execution is sort of this ultimate irrevocable punishment. I think it's quite key to think, like, the risk of executing an innocent person can never be eliminated, can it? I mean, like you said earlier, you know, mm-hmm. people who have come off death row, such mistakes just can't be unmade, which is quite a, you know, difficult thing to deal with. Just got a quote from a US senator in 2000. Since the reinstatement of the modern death penalty, 87 people have been freed from death row because they were later proven innocent. That is a demonstrated error rate of one innocent person for every seven people executed. Do you think this is a sort of incurable infallibility in the process of sentencing and carrying out capital punishment? Do you think that's grounds for getting rid of it altogether?
I mean, I personally think that, I mean, that quote says it all. I don't think we have any right to play with people's lives like that and put them on a death row, put them on a waiting list to be sentenced when there's a possibility they didn't do it. And I also touched upon before the corruption within justice systems. I mean, taking the US for an example, at our previous talk with Jason Baldwin, he said he had been kind of spotted out as someone who was dangerous to, like, safety when he was about 12 years old. And he was being monitored up until the point in which he was put on death row. So it was kind of like you know, they knew that something bad would happen, and he just was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and he ended up nearly dying. So I think, yeah, I think this, that does, is a big reason for why it should potentially be abolished completely.
Yeah, I mean, in the interest of impartiality, I want to play the devil's advocate for a minute here and discuss a few counter-arguments. And this is interesting because I actually couldn't find anyone that was pro-death penalty to come on and discuss with us today, which, you know, says something in itself. So I touched upon this a little bit already, but some would say that criminals deserve to be punished in proportion to the severity of their crime. And I think that actually a lot of people would find that this argument fits with their sort of inherent sense of justice. What would you say to, you know, victims of horrific crimes that feel that capital punishment is the only just response, you know, only way to get justice? How else can they get that sense of closure? And in the interest of protecting society, how can you justify giving a prison sentence to criminals when, you know, with the knowledge that they might one day be released?
Mm-hmm. Well, personally, I feel that we need to be very careful when we use the word justice, and what perhaps we should be talking is retribution and revenge. By just taking away someone's life, by putting them on death row, you're taking away their right to reform, their right to see it within themselves to change. And ultimately, this right of reform, this is what will make a better society. This is how we as a society can help those that are most in need. I mean, if you are the one that kills another man, you are in need from society, and this ability to allow them to reform rather than just taking perhaps what's the easy route and putting drugs into them until they die, mm-hmm. normally, that's not the way that Amnesty International or myself feel that society can progress.
And I would also add to that, like, I think it's really important to consider where a criminal has come from, where, like, that sometimes maybe the state failed them when they were growing up, and that's the reason why they turned to crime. That's the reason why. It's not necessarily they were born an evil person. I mean, I don't know where we stand with, like, are people born good and evil, but I think we need to really consider that. And you know, I couldn't have said it better than Will. I think an important focus should be placed on rehabilitation, re-educating, because I think a lot of the time, and, you know, you said before, in the US, you're more likely to be on death row if you're from a minority. So I think all of these things link to the fact that it's not necessarily like a result of someone psychopathic being like, I want to do the worst thing ever. I think it's often because they've been failed, or they came from some sort of broken home, or, you know, there's so many. I could list 100 reasons why. So I think, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really good response from both of you there. I mean, people in favour of the death penalty might often say as well that it's a useful deterrent for, you know, sort of the most abhorrent crimes in society. So mm-hmm. what would you say in response to that?
I mean, personally, I'd be more terrified of a life in prison than I think the death penalty. I mean, I don't know. I can't say that for sure. I've never been in that position myself. But I think when I think of the two, I think the death penalty is kind of like a get out of jail free card potentially.
Okay.
And I would flatly disagree. I mean, if you look at the statistics, it doesn't add up. It's like when gun advocates in the American states say that more guns brings more safety, it's, you know, it's one of those sort of illogical fallacies where you just kind of have to laugh at them almost.
Yeah, so for instance, a 2012 report by some independent researchers, I think it's important to say, found that US states using the death penalty have a similar murder rate to states that don't use it. I mean, I think you can draw from that the threat of capital punishment doesn't necessarily prevent crime. A Florida judge said if the death penalty is not a deterrent, and it is not, and if the death penalty does not make us safer, and it does not, then it's only a high-cost revenge. And I think mm-hmm. that quote just perfectly embodies what you guys have been saying. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, me too, completely.
Cool. What do we think also about, you know, in opposition to the death penalty, the claim that sort of the anticipatory suffering of the criminal, you know, might be kept on death row for years and years, mm-hmm. Making the punishment sort of even more, I don't know, inhumane perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, as well as Article 3 in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the right to life, there's also the Article 5, which is the right not to be tortured or subjected to cruel or inhuman or degrading punishment. So to keep them on death row, you know, almost indefinitely, as some of these people are, if you look at, I can't remember his name, in Japan, someone's been on death row for 40 years. And similarly, Rodney Reed has been on death row since, I think, 1998. Mm-hmm. And I can't see how this couldn't be anything other than cruel, inhuman, or degrading punishment.
Absolutely. Mm. I mean, do you have anything more to add to that, Leo, or do you agree?
I think I would just completely agree. I think Will said it really well. I think keeping someone on death row in a very small, confined space every day is, you know, inhumane. It's not fair. And if we add into that the statistic you said before, the 1 in 7 in the US not actually being guilty, I mean, you do the math.
It speaks for itself, doesn't it? Yeah, that's been fascinating. Would you both like to make sort of like a closing statement, or tell us a bit of, I mean, well, what you haven't told us, maybe a little bit about what Amnesty here at LU are doing, how students can get involved if they, you know, have been convinced by this debate?
Yeah, I mean, there's actually two things I'd like to say from an Amnesty perspective. Internationally, I think it's fitting that we just have one more desperate plea for Samat Nasim, who I briefly mentioned earlier. He was arrested in 2011 in Iran for being a member of the PJAK, the Party for Free Life of Kurdistan, and he's been on death row since for the last few years. He was due to be executed this morning. There was a last-minute repeal, so he's been taken away, but Amnesty International or no outside observers know where he is now. So if you could please just take 2 minutes to go on the Amnesty International website, there's links to Hassan Rouhani, the president of Iran, and Ayatollah Khomeini, the supreme leader of Iran. If you could please just take 2 minutes to Facebook them and tell them in any language, it doesn't have to be Persian or French, that you feel passionately for Samat Nasim, and that is a desperate plea from Amnesty International. It could be a matter of days before he is re-executed, as it were. And then from LUU Amnesty perspective, our main focus is on Guantanamo Bay. And I don't know how long I have to talk about Guantanamo Bay.
You've got a couple of minutes.
I would love that. It could take months. Our focus is on Shaka Amer. He is the last British man in Guantanamo Bay. He's been there since 2002, since Valentine's Day 2002. Valentine's Day 2002 was also the day when his youngest son, Ferris, was born, who his wife was pregnant when Shaka Amer left for Afghanistan as an aid worker. So he's never met his now 13-year-old son, which is terrible. Shaq has been on, without trial and without charge for 13 years now. He was allowed, President Obama granted him transfer in 2007, meaning that he could be put into either a US domestic prison system and therefore receive trial, or be transferred out of Guantanamo Bay to the UK. But he is still there. He's been on hunger strike for the last 3 years, being force-fed through his nose. He's been beaten. He's been tortured. He, outside evidence, claimed that, as well as post-traumatic stress disorder, he's lost 40% of his body weight through hunger strikes. So we are having an event in 3 weeks' time, on the 5th of March, with a number of prominent speakers. We've got Andy Worthington, the filmmaker who filmed the documentary Outside the Law. We've also got the media rep for the Save Shaka campaign. We hopefully should get some speakers from the law school, and also Sheikh Suleiman Rani, who is a prominent figure in UK and international sort of terrorism legislation and the grey area that between terrorism and human rights that can allow something like Guantanamo and the travesty of Guantanamo to happen. So if you either follow us on Facebook, we'll be uploading that. We'll be uploading regular links to that. It's the Free Shaka Talk from OU Amnesty, or there'll be a lot more hype around the union, hopefully, in the coming few days.
Wonderful. And Leah, do you just want to remind us about your event one more time?
Yeah, amazing. Well, I'd really appreciate, and, you know, I think it'd be so great if everyone could come. It's next Wednesday. The tickets are £4. We're going to be hearing from 2 death row exonerees in person. I mean, this is a really rare opportunity. We usually have Skype ins for our events, but we're lucky enough to have them coming. They usually do tours, Sonny and Peter. And I mean, I'd suggest everyone could, like, if you want, have a little Google of it, get to know their story a bit. They're so interesting. And I think the talk will be really kind of enlightening. And, you know, I think it's such a great opportunity. So get on the LGU Anti-Death Penalty Society page, get your ticket, join the Facebook group, and hopefully see as many of you Leeds students there as possible.
Brilliant. So if you've been inspired or, well, I don't know, persuaded by either of these guests on the GHJ show this afternoon about capital punishment, you can search on Facebook and get involved with our upcoming events and campaigns for both the Anti-Death Penalty Committee Society and LU Amnesty International. Up next, we're going to have a little bit of The Weeknd.
It's magic. Oh, yeah. 'Cause I see nobody, nobody but you, you, you. I'm never confused. Hey, hey, I'm so used to being used. So I love when you call unexpected. 'Cause I hate when the moment's expected. We live with no lies. Hey, hey, you're my favorite kind of night. So I love when you're all unexpected. 'Cause I hate when the moment's expected. So I'm a care for you. I'm a care for you. Yeah.
GHJ show on Leeds Student Radio. You've been listening about some great discussion on capital punishment. Thank you very much to Izzy Thomas for tweeting in. Lots of really interesting conversation going on about capital punishment, something that's still so prevalent, happening every day, and, you know, a matter of life and death. And if you, like I said, if you've been inspired by this conversation, do search Anti-Death Penalty Society, do search Amnesty International, because they are doing such great work at the moment. I'll be back next Thursday, 3 p.m. Thanks a lot for tuning in, and I will see you then.